Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Дамы и господа, это Prevail. И ваш ведущий Грег Олиер.
I'm Greg Oliar. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show. Anthony Scaramucci is here. He is, I think, a polarizing figure in some ways, because you have people who, because he worked in the Trump administration for the 11 days that he did, are never going to forgive him for that. And then you have people, like me, who accept and forgive the 11 days spent there because of how he handled it after, which is he got out and he invested his time and his money and his energy to get Biden elected and get Trump out of office. And it sort of speaks to a similar dynamic that goes on, I think, with a lot of Republicans who went to work for the Trump administration. And Scaramucci is what I would call a money Republican, which is most of the Republicans that I grew up with in the town in New Jersey where I grew up, in my family, in my in-laws' family, people that are motivated more by the economic policies of old-school Republicans, lower taxes, fiscal conservatism, that kind of thing. Scaramucci's definitely cut from that cloth. He's not a, evangelical Christian Republican, which is a completely different animal. I think you had a lot of Republicans, conservatives like him, asked to go work for the Trump administration. And that sets up a choice, a decision, and it's a hard one. And the choice is it better for me to be like, this guy is a monster, fuck this, there's no way I'm working for him? Or is it better to say, I know this guy's a monster, but if I'm not going to go in there and work the job, someone else will, who maybe won't be as qualified, won't be as good at it, and will really bring about a disaster. And if you listen to a lot of the people that left the administration, there was that narrative. And I'm not advocating for the narrative necessarily, but there were people that knew Trump was bad and said, I'm going to make this work in spite of Trump being bad because it's my patriotic duty. That's certainly what, for example, General Kelly has said, and I think that was his outlook when taking that job. And we can nitpick till the cows come home. He's hardly a benign figure in my view. But things got precipitously worse in the Trump administration after he left. So I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. These are hard questions. And if we want to heal as a country and come together and find common ground to make our democracy survive, because our country, our democracy, is under attack from without by forces like the Russians and other hostile countries that are out to attack us and attack our elections, attack our democracy. And it's under assault from within by members of a Republican Party that has become a radical, authoritarian, far-right, fascist party that wants to undermine democracy. We're under attack. We are in crisis right now. And the way out of this crisis, the only way out of this crisis, is to build a coalition so big that the numbers make it impossible for the vocal minority of MAGA nut jobs to take over. That's what we have to do. So it's really essential to understand how we can do that, how we can get through and pierce the Fox News bubble and get through to these people. Lincoln's Bible and I talked about this on the first podcast. We had questions from call-ins asking how we can do this. I think it's a really important issue. I think Biden is trying his best to do it, certainly passing landmark legislation, a relief package that's going to absolutely help everybody, but the red state people as well, right? They're not going to be able to be like, oh, you know, this Biden guy's terrible. They're getting a big check from him. They're getting a vaccine from him. And they're getting stability from him and a functional federal government from him. And people like those things, as it turns out. So this is an interesting thing to think about. How do we reach Republicans who voted for Trump? Not the ones, not the ones on the margins, the radical 10%, the people that showed up at the insurrection, but the old school Republicans, people like members of my family, friends of mine from growing up, that kind of thing. How do we get through to these people and make them understand? How can we, in a perfect world, reshape the Republican Party so that it is no longer a party of authoritarianism and fascism and obstruction and destruction, frankly? The country is best, as we talk about in the podcast. The country is best, it's strongest, when both parties, Democrat and Republican, are strong. And that's what we want. It's baked into the founding documents. That's what we seek. That's what we strive for. To make America great again, we need two functional parties. So how do we achieve that? We talked about a lot of things in the podcast, as you're about to listen to. Scaramucci is much more famous than he was before because of his association with the Trump White House and the fact that he was the media director there for those 11 days. But he's basically a finance guy. He's not a politician, although he is a politician in a sense. I found him extremely warm, extremely smart, and he's the sort of guy that, in my view, looks for common ground. He looks at somebody and he doesn't think, oh, I don't like this guy's this, this, and this. He finds the common ground of things that he does like. And I think that's a valuable skill. He's optimistic, basically. So he was very generous with his time. And I learned a lot because he comes from a finance background. So half of the interview wound up being us talking about economics, which I did not expect and which was fascinating to me. As an English major, I did not take any coursework in economics, but I've read about it. It's interesting to me. And hearing about it from somebody who is in a position to know and has studied it and is a scholar of it and earns his living working in that field is pretty fascinating. So I enjoyed that part of the podcast. He also has some choice words for some Republicans, namely Steve Bannon and Reince Priebus and Kevin McCarthy. So listen up for that. And then at the end, we even talked about Bitcoin, which I don't know anything about Bitcoin. To me, it's completely just, I just don't get it at all. But it was interesting to hear from him, his thoughts on it. And I learned a lot. So Probably there are people among the audience that saw his name on the guest sheet today and sort of rolled their eyes like, oh my God, what's going on here? What is Greg doing? But this, to me, was a fascinating conversation. I really enjoyed it. He was a great guest. So I hope that you get as much out of the interview as I did. We'll be right back with Anthony Scaramucci.
And now, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy unveils the Republican version of the COVID-19 relief bill.
Green Eggs and Ham by Dr. Seuss. I am Sam. I am Sam. Sam I am. That Sam I am, that Sam I am. I do not like that Sam I am. Do you like green eggs and ham? I do not like them, Sam I am. I do not like green eggs and ham.
That was House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy unveiling the Republican version of the COVID-19 relief bill. Now back to the program.
I'm just an Italian kid from Long Island trying to love my country. I have a nice family. I would like to do well for the society. Did I screw up with Trump? Was I overly ambitious? Yes, I was. Did I make mistakes born from ego? Yes, I did. If you've never made a mistake like that, God bless you. But I have, and I have to own that for the rest of my life.
Well, I'm not going to stone you for that here.
That's okay. I've been stoned for that, and I'm okay with it, actually. You know, my friend Tiffany Cross was lighting me up a few weeks ago on MSNBC. We've subsequently patched it up. My attitude is we're in a very rough period of time for the United States because you've got 74 million people that voted for Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And some of them voted for him because they think, well, I like his policies better and I'm going to hold my nose related to everything else that he's doing. And then you have another group of people that are like, hey, you know what? Whites are losing power in the country. And this country was way better when whites had power. And I would like the whites to stay in power. And so I'm going to vote for Donald Trump. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. And I think it speaks to what I want to talk. There's a whole bunch of questions that I want to talk about. So before we get into...
Are we live now or not yet? Okay, you tell me when
we're live. We're live. I want to say, first of all...
I don't like leaving things on the cutting room floor. We're ready to go. I'm ready to rock and roll.
First of all, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it. This is a new podcast. I've been writing the column for over a year, but the podcast is pretty new. So I appreciate you taking the time. I really do. Thank you.
My pleasure.
I want to go back a little bit. We were talking before, I think before I hit the record button, about your background. So first question, you graduated Tufts, you went to Harvard Law School, but you never practiced law. So my question is, at what point in law school did you realize you didn't want to be a lawyer? Was it like the first week?
So I graduated in 1986 from Tufts. I want to give you a perspective of how naive I was. My father and mother, okay, they actually thought the spelling of Tufts was T-O-U-G-H-S. They had no clue. My mother thought I got into Hartford Law School. She didn't realize it was Harvard Law School. And then even when I told her what Harvard Law School was, she didn't understand it. And again, I'm not picking on my parents. God bless them. My mom's actually smart. They're just not well-read. They didn't go to college. My dad was a crane operator for 42 years in the town that I grew up in. It's sort of a geological phenomenon that Long Island is a glacial deposit. So, you know, the glaciers came through your area up in New Paltz, crushed everything. You know, the Catskills, geologists think the Catskills were actually taller than the Himalaya Mountains before they were mowed down by the glaciers.
Oh, wow.
So the glaciers came in, mowed everything down. The rubble of that is Long Island, Block Island. It is the elbow of Cape Cod. It's Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard. Manhattan Island, interestingly, is broken granite. That broke off from the continent. So it's sort of interesting. That's why you're able to put so many skyscrapers there. But so my father's dad was a coal miner, and he emigrated to Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania from Italy. And so he told my father, stay out of these mines. And so my father and his older brother responded to newspaper advertising to mine sand on Long Island. And so he got here uneducated. And he developed a crane operating skill, 42 years as a crane operator. So the reason I'm giving you that backdrop before I get into Tufts and Harvard is I was remarkably naive. It's right. 1985. I'm reading that lawyers at Cravath, Swain & Moore, which is a very prestigious law firm that I probably couldn't have got it hired at. That's all the thing. They're making $65,000 a year. It's 1985. I read this article in Time magazine. And then I said to myself, oh, my God, that's more money than my dad makes. My dad's making $33,000, $34,000 a year. I could leave school. Yes, I'll have some school debt, but I'll be making twice what my dad makes. Why would I need any more money than that? I mean, this is literally the level of naivete. So I went to law school. My first job in the legal world was right after I graduated from college. I worked for a guy named Rich Signorelli, who became a DA in the Southern District. He was at Harvard Law School. He hired me as a paralegal in the summer of 1986 between Tufts and law school. Greg, I hated every minute of it. I hated every minute. I thought I was going to kill myself. Okay, I was like, this is not for me. I went to my parents. I told my mother I didn't want to go to law school. I was going to see if I can get into a business school. And then my mother is like, you know, a combination of Everybody Loves Raymond, you know, the mother Marie from Ray's show, right? And the mother that was dying in Moonstruck. Remember the mother dying in Moonstruck every 5 minutes, right? Yeah. So if you take those two and you genetically combine them, that's my mother, Marie Scaramucci, right? I'm gonna commit suicide. You're going to commit suicide? Yeah, if you don't go to law school, I'm committing suicide. This is how my mother talks, right? So I said to myself, okay, no problem. I'm going to go to law school. So now I'm there hating it. Gee, some of the courses were actually pretty good. I took Larry Tribe's course in con law, Philip Heyman's course in criminal procedure. I enjoy, you know, because I'm an academic, I enjoy studying. But I was like, I got to get the hell out of here. So I crossed the river, Charles River, went over to the Business School Resource Center, and I started interviewing for investment banking jobs. And now this is the best. Okay, you got to hear this because you got some Italian origin, okay? I got my Goldman Sachs interview, and they have these conference rooms set up at the Charles Hotel in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I show up in my black Guido 100% polyester suit, 100% polyester, but there's more. 100% polyester white on white shirt. Remember the white on white threading shirts?
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Then I had the black Guido tie with the thin knot. Okay. But no, it's not enough. I've got the capizios on, you know, the cockroach killing capizios. And my hair's blown back like Travolta in Saturday Night Fever. And I walk into the Goldman interview and these guys are looking at me. And then I start giving them my exposition on the TED spread and present value, why LIBOR rates are where they are, where the euro dollar is. And we're going back into the 80s. The guy gets up. He's like, look, you're a smart kid. You are the worst dressed person that we've ever met at the Harvard Law. The worst. Now, listen to me. I can't invite you back to Goldman Sachs looking like this. I remember I went like red, like a cherry tomato. And I said, really? I thought it's my best call. I thought, you know, call my mother. Of course, mother being in town. You looked great. What is that guy talking about? You looked great. I said, look, I don't think I look great, Ma. So I went to Brooks Brothers. I put it on my credit card. I bought two suits, three shirts, and I went down to Goldman Sachs for my final round interviews. I got the job. That is my odyssey into finance, all born from naivete. And by the way, Greg, since you're an investigative journalist, I just want you to think about this. You're going from a blue-collar neighborhood where your father's wearing a greenie, which is a green uniform, to operate a crane.
Yeah.
You've never seen the inside of a country club. You've never hit a golf ball. You never swung a tennis racket. And now you're propped in with all these prep school guys at Goldman Sachs. And listen, Goldman was a phenomenal place. I loved working there. But I always knew I had to start my own business in order to not shave the hard points or the sharp points off my personality. I didn't want to be this, you know, banker, you know, like this robotic banker. Yeah. So now I'm in the FA area, financial advisor. Goldman gives me a desk, a telephone, and a business card. Go find clients. I'm like, okay, how the hell am I going to do this? I don't know anybody. I mean, I went to Harvard. It's an old boys network, but I'm a young boy at that time at the age 25, 26. So I make a decision, rightly or wrongly, that if I go into the political world, I can meet people. It'll help me grow my business. So I write my first check in 1989 to Rudolph Giuliani for mayor. $250 check. I wish I had the check, actually, because it would be sort of fun to have it. And I'm young Republicans for Mayor Giuliani, or candidate for Mayor Giuliani. Right. He loses. Great, great for me. Because now I become friends with him. You know, I go to his office. He's at White and Case. I said, this is my business. Well, how do I do this? Well, here's what you got to do. And then I said, well, sir, can you introduce me to people? He starts to introduce me to a lot of people. I start building an account base. He wins the mayor's race in 93. He introduces me to a guy named George Pataki, becomes a 12-year, three-term Republican governor of New York, last Republican governor. And then Rudy's Rudy. So what does Rudy do? He introduced me to Pataki. I go to work for Pataki. And then he endorses Mario Cuomo. That's Rudy. Okay, Rudy's been nuts. Rudy's been nuts from day one. Okay, he just was able to control the nuttery until I guess he got to a point in life, in his life, where he didn't care anymore. You know. And by the way, when we talked to Rudy today, why are you doing this? You know. And it's all about the bubble. You know. He wants to live in the bubble. He wants to be part of the attention. Well, what about your legacy? I mean, you helped turn New York around. You helped us at 9/11. Ah, I don't care about my legacy. I'll be dead. That's Rudy.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's my odyssey, just to give you some color and context. So
no, that's a fun odyssey.
I'm accidentally in politics.
That was my next question anyway. I was going to ask you, how did you pivot into politics with, you know, if it was
total accident, because I was a Republican fundraiser, which was helping me build my network. And so I want you to think about this. If I was that politically minded, wouldn't I have been in politics at age 30, age 40, age 50? No, I'm in politics at age 53 because Donald Trump, who none of us thought was going to win the presidency.
Right.
And this is my stupidity. So I have to own this for the rest of my life. I'm working for Jeb. Jeb comes out of the race. Trump calls to recruit me. I have a relationship with Trump. Nobody is friends with Trump. Anybody that tells you that they're friends with Trump, they either don't understand what a friendship is, or they're lying and exaggerating their social relationship with Donald Trump. He has no friends. He has acquaintances and connections, and he's such a user
right.
that he'll use you temporarily and then run you over with a Mack truck when he's done using you. So, you know, anyway, I have a relationship with him. I'm working at CNBC. He's working at NBC. We go to parties together. I see him at Yankee games. I actually see him at a few Met games. We're actually both Met fans. We went to the White House correspondence.
Wait, Trump is a Met fan?
Trump's a Met fan. He grew up in Queens.
Yeah, but that doesn't. Yeah. I would think he would root for the Yankees just as.
Yeah, well, he's one of. I'm a Met fan.
Yeah,
I did not root for the Yankees until after 9/11. My attitude is after 9/11. I mean, I'm going to confess to you, you probably have Yankee fans on your podcast, but, you know, I hated the Yankees. I had Yankee envy. So I was a Met fan my whole life, hated the Yankees. After 9/11, if a New York team is playing anywhere in the world, I'm rooting for the New York team.
Sure.
That's just my thing after 9/11, last 20 years. So I do root for the Yankees when they're playing. If they get to the World Series, you want to talk about pain for a Met fan? 2009, the Yankees are playing the Phillies. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Those are the two teams you hate the most. I had a root for the Yankees because I'm a New Yorker. But back on this, because I think it's important, I know him. I think he's a little nuts. He calls me the day after the Apprentice finale. Well, actually, he doesn't call me that. He invites me to breakfast the day after the Apprentice finale. So I show up in his office. Wasn't I great? Did you see me on TV last night? No, I didn't watch that. I don't watch that bullshit. Ah, well, you were the only one. I mean, the ratings were fantastic. And this is how he talks, right? So I'm done with that. I'm running for president. I like literally laugh. I like, you're not going to, you know, running for president. I mean, come on. I know you're probably going to do it for publicity. No, I'm going to run for president. And by the way, when I run, I'm going to go right to the top of the polls and I'm going to stay there. I said, well, you know, that's great, but I'm working for Scott Walker already. And if Scott comes out of the race, I'm going to be with Jeb Bush. Trump looks at me and says, okay, that's fine. If Jeb comes out of the race, you'll come work for me. You're good on TV. You know how to raise money, you know, blah, blah. And then I stupidly, cavalierly say, yeah, no problem. I'll come work for you. I mean, that's colossal mistake number one. You know, H&R Block had all the mistakes, you know, like all the tax tips. I probably, right. You know, you don't have enough time for every mistake that I made over the last 4 years. So that was colossal mistake number one. I said, okay, Jeb comes out of the race. He's a very good friend of mine.
Can I ask you about Jeb before you go on?
Sure. Absolutely.
Because I think at the time, most people, I know I did, most people thought Jeb was going to be the nominee and run on the ticket in 2016. He seemed to have the best, the Republican old family bona fides and the money, and everybody knew who he was. So why do you think that he didn't succeed?
Flat. He'd be mad at me if he listens to your podcast, but he's flat. You know, he's a wonk. He would have been a very successful mid-1990s candidate. You know, he's a wonk. You have a transformation in our society as a result of social media and cable news and news cycling that's moving at a rapid pace, where the country wants to be entertained by their political leaders. The country really wants that. It's not a, here's the political leader, ready? I have to be a policy wonk. I have to be well-traveled. I have to be someone that can network and cut a deal in a bipartisan way. And then I have to be a television host and an entertainer, and I have to be a charismatic. I've got to do all of those things at the same time in order to capture the imagination of the people, unless I'm running against a orange-painted, full-blown sociopath that is a Russian operative. Mm-hmm. So if I'm running against an orange-painted, full-blown sociopath that's a Russian operative, I just have to be the antidote to that. And 71 million people will not be enough to vote for the orange-painted, or 74 million people won't be enough to vote for the orange-painted Russian operative. But that's it. If you don't see, like, I'm going to say something. Vice President Harris is going to be mad at me now, too. She's flat. She's flat. And she's got a great resume, great career. I'm sure she's very competent, but she didn't grab hold in the campaign due to the flatness. Okay. And so that's why they went with Biden, because Biden was like the anti-Trump.
I thought I loved Kamala. I just want to say it for the record. I didn't think she was flat. But I
thought she was flat, and I like her. You know, I was on a trip to Israel. I met her and her husband Doug on a trip to Israel. Mm-hmm. We were there at the Hotel David, you know, in Jerusalem, and it's called the King David. But anyway, I liked her. I'll tell you a quick funny story. The photographer that was taking the pictures, she's like, Senator Harris, can I get a picture with you and the mooch? She's like, no way. I'm not ruining my political career. I thought that was an awesome comment. You know what I mean? So she's got good judgment. She's got good judgment. But she's a little flat. I mean, and again, I'm not trying to be offensive to her.
No. It's an analysis.
By the way, I have her as the odds-on favorite. She has a very strong chance to be president because she's competent. She's going to build a nice network. I don't know if President Biden is running again or not. I don't know. We'll have to see what happens. But if he's not running again, I think she's in the pole position for the nomination.
Oh, I think so, too. And I know what you're saying about the people running for president. In a sense, it's the people vote for someone who ran the best campaign. Yeah. And the person that runs the best campaign isn't necessarily the person that would be the best president
Let me reframe it for you from my perspective. It's a marketing competition.
Yeah, no, it is. It's absolutely is.
So at the end of the day, if you're the better marketer, better sales, remember, whatever you think of Donald Trump or whatever I think of him, he has a smash mouth way of talking that will force you to listen to him. It's almost like verbal rubbernecking. Like he's like creating a verbal car crash. So you're flipping through you see him, you say, okay, this idiot is going to say something ridiculous. Let me just see what he's going to say now. And you stop and watch him.
Yeah, he has that. Well, I think Bernie has that too. Not the stop and watch it, but when Bernie talks, and I'm not a Bernie fan at all. I've written a lot of stuff opposed to him. When he talks, he has that way that makes you just sort of stop and listen to what he's saying, because he sounds
and he's very smart. Bernie's very smart, but Bernie's misguided because what everybody does, and when they're moving towards socialism and communism, they're giving you the thin layer of idealism related to it, but they're not giving you the underlayer of human behavior. We're not designed for communism.
No,
do you know why we're not designed for communism? We're too goddamn selfish, Greg.
Yeah.
As a group of people. And so what we have to do is you have to flatten the incentive structure so that you can fortify the economy and lift the boats. You're not going to do it the way we're doing it right now, by the way. You're widening the income gap now. That's very dangerous. That's going to lead to more populism, more nationalism. The economic policies that we are executing right now are very bad for the country long term.
You mean the economic policies that Biden is executing or the ones
from
before?
No, it's a bipartisan thing. It's bipartisan. Okay. It actually started with George Bush. Obama was carrying it out. Trump carried it out. And now, unfortunately, President Biden is carrying it out. And what is that policy? We're going to do nothing on infrastructure. We're going to do nothing on jobs training. We're going to do nothing on right-sizing or reforming our K through 12 public education system, because it's unbelievably uneven, Greg. If you're in a good zip code, you get a great public school education. If you're not in a good zip code, you get a terrible one. So we're doing nothing for any of that. Our bridges, roads, and tunnels are going to crumble. Our airports are going to fall into themselves. But what we're going to do is we're going to lower interest rates. And that's going to be our monetary policy. And so when you lower interest rates, what happens is the people that have the assets, they get very, very rich. But the people that don't have assets and they need their labor, which is a measurement of their time to make money for their family, those stagnate. And then if you want to cripple the situation with a COVID-19 crisis, you've got 27 million people out of work. So the wages are not moving.
Yeah.
So you can lower the rates. My stock portfolio will go up. Okay. My real estate will go up. Because you've remember, interest rates are the physical gravity of financial assets. So you lower them, the assets levitate. But it doesn't solve the problem of working class people or middle class people. Bernie Sanders gets that, believe it or not. But his solutions are remarkably flawed and would actually create a worse problem for those people. So that's the irony of the whole thing.
Well, I don't think he doesn't think past, him specifically, he doesn't think past step one of break up the bank. When I stopped believing with him, he campaigned on break up the banks, we're going to break up the banks. And then someone at the New York Daily News asked him, how would you break up the banks? And he couldn't answer the question. And I was like, that's your whole campaign. You can't, if I could call Hillary Clinton and wake her up in the middle of the night and say, how would we break up the banks? And she might not agree with it, but she would know how to do it. But getting back to the taxes, it's
that
interesting.
That would be a really bad thing to do, by the way, breaking up the banks.
Yeah, right.
It would be a horrific thing to do, and it would make the poor poorer. We have an underbanking crisis in our society for poor people, so we have to fix that. But breaking up the banks would not fix that. Moreover, you're in a global competition, so while we're blowing up our banks, China's banks are growing, the European banks are growing, and whether you like it or not, the banks are the circulatory system for your economic society. So if you want to break up the banks, you'll slow down the capital that's flowing through the society and you'll blow up jobs.
Now, when you were talking about rates before, are you talking about tax rates? Because
Interest rates.
Because the period of time in the United States when the marginal tax rate was the highest was under Eisenhower in the 1950s, and it corresponded with the greatest boom in our economy in the history of the country, or close to. So,
okay. So, can I give you my theory?
Yeah. Because I'm sure you're opposed, but I'm just curious.
No, not at all. I'm
an English major too, so you can. Yeah.
All right, but Greg, I'm balanced. I'm really not opposed. I'm balanced. I just want to explain to you my observation. Less my 11-day disaster in the White House. I've been doing this for 33 years. And I'm a trained economist and I've analyzed those different periods of time. And so what's happening in the Eisenhower era, they're equating something that doesn't work. Like I'm touching my knee right now. And so that means the Mets are going to win. Okay. Cause every time I touch my knee, the Mets win. You see what's happening? You've got a fact set that you're connecting to something.
So you're saying that the Eisenhower
boom is because of this. These men, and it was mostly men. I mean, Perkins was a woman labor secretary, but the Eisenhower boom is from the post-World War II texture that was created by these men at the end of the war that led to that boom. And you have to remember, in the United States at that time, we were the last standing industrial superpower.
Right.
Europe was destroyed so badly we had to give them the martial law. Northern Asia, Japan, parts of China destroyed. And the Soviet Union had an okay economy, but they had to think totally backwards because of the communist incentives. So that made the United States this uber powerful creature after the war, which touched off that economic boom. The confiscatory tax rates probably slowed it down a little bit, to be honest, okay? And it didn't contribute to the boom. But having said that, okay, the best era was actually the Clinton era, where the tax rates were reasonably high. And I'll take you back 30 years.
Yeah.
He raised taxes in 93 to the great objection of the Republicans. And he put the marginal tax rate back up to 39.6%. Mm-hmm. And he said that he was doing that to add fiscal discipline and fiscal price stability, because what he didn't want to do is he didn't want to increase domestic spending without having a commensurate tax increase. So it was actually very smart, fiscally prudent.
Right.
In a weird way, he's more conservative than the conservatives, because the conservatives have lost that standing. All they do is spend money now.
Oh, it's crazy.
They spend it wildly. But, you know, you don't need to hear all my BS, but I'll just say this to you. We're at our best when the tax rates for the very wealthy are around 50%, that's state and local income taxes. And we're at our best when we're spending about 22% of our GDP in federal outlays, meaning the budget is about 22%. And I can show you through economic history, when we're at those levels, we get exciting growth and we get a deepening of economic opportunity and economic aspiration for our fellow Americans. And that's what my dad benefited from, because my dad had very high hourly wages. Mm-hmm. Post-World War II society, demand for his labor, but also there was a lot of economic growth. Now, the big mistake that the hoi polloi are making right now is they want the last $10 billion in their bank account. If they took the last 10, so listen, I'm XYZ, I'm worth $150 billion, and now I want to be worth $160 billion. Do you really, though? I mean, what do you need that money for? If you took the last $10 billion and you gave it to your workers, what would happen was you would create and prime the pump of aggregate demand.
Right.
You'd create more consumption, more disposable income. You see what I mean? So the more you pay the middle and lower class, okay, the better the society, not only because, you know, you're helping those people, but also because they're going to spend more money. They're going to make you richer. The $15 minimum wage, as an example, okay, Romney and I have talked about this, and we're both in support of it. The $15 minimum wage, it creates jobs. When these bozos say, well, it's not going to create any jobs because, you know, that $7 an hour guy, he's not going to get the job now because they're charging $15. That's a bunch of malarkey, just so you know. And then secondarily, that extra money that you're paying them, they're going to put it into the economy. So it has a virtuous circle effect in the economy. So
what do you think about?
I mean, I didn't realize we were going to have an economic discussion.
Me neither.
Sorry if I'm derailed.
But you know about it. It's fascinating to me.
This is my life. I spent my whole life studying this, you know.
I'm going to ask.
That's why I got killed in Washington, because I didn't know. These people are the most vicious people I've ever met in my life. I told my Wall Street buddies, I mean, you think you guys are like sharks and tough guys and everything. You're a bunch of babies compared to these people in Washington. These people in Washington rip your eyeballs out.
Prevail is brought to you by Glow Stick Army, the new album from Halo. All the things that you told me. We'll be right back.
Greg LO. Sneak preview available now at halo.bandcamp.com. Now back to the program.
So we'll go there because we could talk about economics all day. But I'm curious about a couple things about your time in the White House. Famously, 11 days.
Yes.
You're there. What I'm most curious about with people that are there, that are inside the room, is the personalities and the dynamics of the people that were there. So who was your favorite person to work with, and who was your least? And you cannot answer the second part if you don't want to.
No, of course I'll answer the second part. I got to think about the favorite. You know, yeah. My favorite person to work with was Kurt Schiller, the president's body man, and I'd say he was tied with Johnny McEntee. So Johnny McEntee was the president's like aide. He went on to become the president's personnel director. And I actually hired Johnny McEntee after he got fired by John Kelly for the gambling issue that he had. Okay. Why were those guys my favorite? Because they were no nonsense guys. You know, they believed in Trump, but they were just doing their jobs, and they were no nonsense guys. They didn't have that nefarious backstabbing, let me leak something about you to the press, but say nice things to your face. I'm all about the power of being here. They were actually just there to do their jobs. So yeah. Those are my two favorites. My least favorite person to work with was Reince Priebus.
That's what I was going to guess.
He was the lowest form of life. He is the most slippery, dishonest hypocrite. Now, he's not that smart. Okay, we'll talk about Bannon if you want. Bannon's smart. But yeah. Priebus is a dishonest, slithering hypocrite. And the thing with Priebus is that because he knows he's not that smart, he will breach any ethic. He will do anything to amass power. He's now apparently going to run for governor of Wisconsin and all this sort of stuff. But he is one of the worst people that I've ever met in my life. So he's the worst by far. Okay. And I have nicknames for him, but we can't use them on your podcast because it's not appropriate. Now, Bannon is a different guy. Bannon's more dangerous, believe it or not, than Priebus. Bannon is well-read. He's articulate. Okay, he's a charismatic Bannon. But you know why? You know, you've got the Pietà behind you, and I am a Catholic, and I believe in God. But when my faith in God is tested, do you know why I believe in God and will forever believe in God, Greg? You want to know why?
Yeah, tell me.
Steve Bannon. Let me explain why. Steve Bannon is a charismatic. He's well-read. He is an evil, nefarious James Bond villain.
Yes.
Okay. But God made him. Are you allowed to curse on this podcast or no?
Yeah, you can say whatever you want.
All right. God made him so motherfucking ugly. Okay? He's got that fucking alcoholic nose, and he's got that fucking contemporary hobo fashion, and he's got that fucking basketball belly. You know what I'm saying? That God said, okay, we're going to make Steve super smart. We'll make him a white supremacist. He'll be the descendant of Adolf Hitler, and he'll write Mein Kampf Volume 3, and it'll rile people up, but it'll be so motherfucking ugly that no one will really pay a full amount of attention to him. Now, my only contribution to our civilization thus far is getting that son of a bitch out of the White House. Because when my suicide vest was going off, I was reaching for Bannon. And you can ask General Kelly this, okay? Bannon got blown into Pennsylvania Avenue. He was fired on the same day as me. He begged Trump to give him an extra 14 days, 2 weeks. And Trump relented and allowed that. But we were both going out on the same day, but for that, okay? And I just want you to imagine the 2020 situation with Bannon in the White House with Trump and the insurrection situation on the 6th of January with Bannon organized. See, Trump is not organized. He's evil, malevolent. He's nefarious, but he has no executive management skills.
No.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, I'm sure he got his loans paid off by Putin, and I'm sure they paid him a fortune to do everything he did to hurt our society. But he's not organized. Bannon is organized. Okay, yeah. So that's my only contribution right now to our society. That I grabbed that son of a bitch as my vest was going off. He got blown into Pennsylvania Avenue with me.
Well, good on that, because that guy's dangerous. I,
Very, very scary.
And he remains dangerous. And I've offered
to debate him anywhere, anytime. I've offered to debate him live, 92nd Street Y. He can pick the moderator. We can do it on television. We can do it on stage. I've offered to debate him because all of his imagery and all of his statements are illusory. And so what's happening is he is very good at somebody that's relatively uneducated or relatively unread, pinning them with certain identification things the way they do in these cults.
Right.
And getting them excited about something. And it's actually in their worst interest to be excited about that. And so, but that's what he don't want to be in the same room as me.
Good.
Contemporary hobo. He's, you know, fashion by contemporary hobo.
Yeah, he's got
nose by full-on alcoholic, thank God, because, you know, he would have done a lot of damage to the society. He's still doing damage to the society, but just it's not going to be as consequential now.
No, he's not when he's not. It's better that he's not on the National Security Council, certainly. I remember when he first came onto the scene, there was these horrible pictures of him, and I used to call him just drunk Nazi. That was my, I think I hashtagged drunk Nazi. So
yeah, well, there you go. I mean, so you're more descriptive than me. You're a better writer, but I mean,
no, I think you nailed it pretty well. I'm not.
but Greg, here's the thing though. Like, you know, I'd like to tell you that. I mean, you know, this is an admission, and it doesn't reflect well on me. I literally knew that Trump was nuts, and I decided to work for him anyway. Okay, and I bet you there's a lot of people like that. And so this doesn't reflect well on me. Secondarily, what doesn't reflect well on me is I was trying to form fit my narrative, and I was overlooking things that somebody like me should never overlook. So my wife would say to me, like, my wife probably hates him almost as much as Melania hates him. You know, I think you got to give Melania her due, right? I mean, she hates him more than anybody. You got to give her the number one position. But my wife has got to be in the top five. And we almost got divorced over this fiasco. You know, so she knew. But I was saying to myself this hagiographic self-narrative. I went to public school, Tufts and Harvard. I built some successful businesses. Now I have a chance to work for the American president. Well, the American president's a sociopath, and the American president's an evil guy, and he's trying to hide his racism by splitting participles. So you're still going to go work for him? Yes, I am, because it fits my narrative, right? I'm this American dream kid, grew up in a modest family. I'm now going to go work for the American president. And I literally, through cognitive dissonance, Greg, overlooked things.
Now, your
friend, Mrs. Lincoln's Bible, who, you know, started out hating my ass, but I think she at least respects me now, okay? What she would say, and she's right, you better own the contribution to the pain that you caused by working for him. Because he is a racist, and he is a dividing figure, and he did consequential damage to the United States. He made the country weaker, sicker, and poorer. And you cause pain by working for him, by overlooking those things. And so you have to acknowledge that, and you have to own that. And she's 100% right about that. And I have tried to do that, and I've offered up my apologies. Some people will forgive me, and other people will hold that against me for the rest of my life. But the one thing I'm very proud of is that when I looked at the situation in August of 2019, he had the highest poll numbers. He was at his peak of his popularity. Never got to 50%, but it was edging there.
Mm-hmm.
And I got on the TV and said, I can't take this anymore. The guy's a full-on racist, and I'm sorry. I'm disavowing my opinion of him. And I predict that he will either get knocked out and removed by the Republicans and won't be the nominee, or if he runs and he is the nominee, he's going to lose. And that, you know, Jonathan Swan did that article in August of 2019, I had calls from Republicans telling me I was nuts. I was a kamikaze pilot. Why would I say that? Now, and it hurt my business. You know, people leave my business. Wait a minute, you're not a Trump supporter? Well, I'm for low taxes and, you know, tight borders. I'm redeeming millions of dollars out of your fund. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
But my point is, at least I had the stomach for going after him and explaining to the best of my capabilities what he was doing, and conjoined with others to work as hard as possible to defeat him. Because I'm telling you, 4 more years of him, Greg, that would have been really, really bad for our country.
No, it would have been over. The democracy would have been over. I mean, there's no question. I don't think people realize, like, after the election was over, I wasn't happy. I was more like, my analogy was, I felt like Tom Hanks in Castaway when at the end, when he's just sitting looking at the big plate of food and he's snipping the lighter on and off. That's what I felt like. I wasn't happy. I was like, I'm so glad I'm off the island, but man, this is nothing's never going to be the same. So, okay, you mentioned Lincoln's Bible. So in the first episode of my podcast, she and I talked about the future of the GOP, and there has to be a sort of come to Jesus moment with the 74 million people who voted for Trump. Right? They don't have to like Biden. They don't have to agree with us or with the policies, but they do have to recognize reality. And how do you do that? How do you, make them come to that conclusion? Because it's one of those things, I think they need to come to it on their own. Some Kamala-loving schmuck like me, saying, I told you so, is not going to make anybody happy about it. So you've spoken a lot of times, the word you use is off-ramp. An off-ramp for the voters who voted for Trump. Do you think that January 6th was the off-ramp for enough people? And if it wasn't, what is going to be? What do you think?
So, no, I mean, it was for some people. They lost registrations, and people did disaffect from the Republican Party. But it's not enough, no, because he's got 80%. I mean, here's the good news, and I've said this before, but I'll repeat it here. Trump is a unifying figure. What do I mean by that? Well, he's got 80% of the support of the Republicans, but the Republicans are now down to 25% of the registrants as a result of Trump's antics. Mm-hmm. And so that means that he's got 20% of the public. He's got 80% of the Republicans. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that means 75% of us got unified to defeat Donald Trump. And if you look at the math, it's roughly right.
Yeah.
And it's weird, though. AOC probably doesn't like me, although I really do admire her. I don't agree with her policies. I admire her hustle. But think about it. AOC, me, and Rick Wilson are teamed up together.
Yeah.
You can't have a better definition of Trump being a unifying figure than that. So he just happens to be unifying us against him. But the off-ramp is a problem. And I'm going to explain to you why. Because when Disney is putting a warning, Surgeon General's warning on the Muppets show, and they're saying that this could be racially charged and it could be racially offensive, don't, or watch this at your peril, but we're going to put it up on our Disney Plus. A guy like Joe Biden, because I've gotten to know him. He's come to my conference. We had dinner together. I worked on the campaign. It was helpful on debate prep. A guy like Joe Biden would say, that's killing us, because when you're doing this woke sort of stuff, okay, and I'm being called a white supremacist, which I have been, I've lived in white privilege, and so therefore I'm a white supremacist. I'm not a white supremacist, that's fine. But when you're going to that degree, you're pushing that 25 into a hardened silo, Greg. You see what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
That's dangerous for the society. So what has to happen is we need a Republican leader, and it has to be an Obama-like figure. And what do I mean by that? It has to be somebody that is got a little bit of the MAGA DNA, frankly, okay, but a lot of the gravitas and a lot of the maturity to weld and re-knit a coalition. If you want a Republican Party, I'm assuming that you're a rationalist like me, where I want a smart and I want a fervent and vibrant, virile Democratic Party.
Yeah.
Because that is the best. You want to talk about being the best? Greg, yeah. I can tell you, when we have a strong Democratic Party and a strong Republican Party, we are at our best. I can show you that.
It's
on a set of charts,
it's baked into the system. The two-party system is baked into the founding documents. And nobody wants a stronger Republican Party more than I do. I mean, Pelosi said the same thing.
We don't know each other that well, right? We're just getting to know each other.
So yeah.
I'm making that assumption based on your writing and your rationality. So I want a vibrant Republican Party. I don't want a radical right, Christian, white supremacist.
Obstructionist
party. I don't want that. I want a party of Republicans that are grounded in some principles and grounded in some common sense around the economy. Frankly, I think the Republicans are making a mistake on the social issues.
Yep.
I'm a social agnostic. I'm a libertarian. I laugh at my conservative friends. So let me get this right. You want a smaller government, but you want a larger government in my bedroom. So whatever I'm doing in my bedroom, you want to have control over. But in every other part of the society, you want a smaller government. And oh, by the way, the statistics don't say that, by the way. The conservatives want a larger and larger and larger government. I'm going to tell you something, because look at the way they spend.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you something about these people that Trump got. Because you could dislike Trump, we could demonize Trump, but he's a person and he's got intuition related to politics. Otherwise, he couldn't have won the presidency. Trump got that the current conservatives are ready. They're socially conservative and fiscally liberal. So they want free stuff from the government. Okay, and but they're clutching to this idea of this, you know, religiosity, if you will.
Yeah.
And Trump got that. You know, they're not fiscal conservatives. You know, they're standing there in the Tea Party with these placards, get your government hands off my health care.
Right.
You know, Medicare. That's a government program. You get hold on, what are you doing? What do you mean it's a government program? No, it's a government program. You're saying get your government hands off the Medicare. Lyndon Johnson put that in place in 1965. Oh, you see, yeah. You see what's going on?
There's a lot of cognitive dissonance is what you said before. And there's a lot of that in the Republican
Party. We have to do is we have to find leadership. Maybe it's Kissinger. Maybe it's Cheney.
That brings me to the – I have that.
Maybe it's somebody else. But we have to find somebody that can go to the – hard right, the MAGA people say, time out a second. Let's operate with rationality. Let's take a little bit of the emotion down. What is it that you want? Now, if they say, well, we only want white people to run the government. Well, you guys say, okay, well, I'm sorry, that's not how it works. Okay. And by the way, what are you fearing about black and brown people? What's your fear about them? Is it tribal? Is it primordial? Because I have found that when people connect with each other, whatever their colors are, whatever their religions are, they realize that they have way more in common than what separates them.
Absolutely.
But Greg, let's see, there's 10% lunatics on the right and there's 10% lunatics on the left. I'm never going to reach those people. So now you got to go for the 80%.
Yeah.
And of the 80%, you got to win 50 of them, 60 of them, and you're good. So I'm hoping that a leader emerges politically that can synthesize and can respect MAGA without talking down to them or being belligerent or being elitish, but say, okay, look, I get what you want, but what you're saying and how you're going about it is not American. It's not even American. Make America great again. Your positions are actually anti-American. They lack plurality. They lack constitutionalism. They lack the ideas of the democracy, the ideals of it.
Mm-hmm.
And but what is it that you're really getting at? So to me, I think the 74 million is a noise, not a signal. Now, let me explain that. Now, McConnell and McCarthy think it's a signal. They think 74 million, they voted for Trump. That's a signal. Let's kiss Trump's ass. Otherwise, we're going to get primary. Right. I see it as a noise. I see it as a noise. What do I mean by a noise? I am upset. I can't get work. My father was blue collar. He's economically aspirational. My generation, I'm economically desperational. I can't get work. I'm upset. I can't afford my lifestyle. I can't afford my kids. I'm upset. MAGA. Let's go march on the Capitol. But if I am working and I've got a job, I mean, this is the same thing with terrorism, Greg. You know, you want to stop terrorism, give the kid a cool American T-shirt, an iPhone and a girlfriend and ear pods. And then you don't have a terrorist because he's got some fun things to do. But if he's got nothing to do and he's economically desperate and he feels like his life is a waste, now he's going to make a statement with his life.
Well, a lot of the thing, I know what you're saying, but a lot of the people that went to that march were not economically desperate. There was a lot of people that had, that flew there on private planes. There were people that had their boats with the Trump flag on them.
I get that.
Also a lot of the guys also live with their moms. I mean, that's also true.
But I get that. But I did say to you, 10% of the people are crazy. There are there are rich white supremacists in our country.
Absolutely.
There are. Okay. And so I did see, I'm seeding that 10% of the people are crazy.
All right, I'm gonna two more questions and then we'll wrap it up because we've been on. I could talk to you all day. This has been really fun. Okay, so after the impeachment, the second impeachment, I said to my son who's 16, I said, Liz Cheney, put money on it now. I wish I could bet right now that Liz Cheney is going to be the Republican nominee, the Republican candidate for president in 2024. You know, put. Lock it up, load it. That's it. It's going to be her. And I was very confident.
I can be honest with you. I could support somebody like her.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Liz Cheney has a set of principles that she stuck with. 70% of her voters voted for Donald Trump. She voted to convict and impeach him, and she's held her ground.
Yeah.
Kevin McCarthy, to me, is one of the more disappointing people in our civilization because I know Kevin, and I was a supporter of Kevin's. And Kevin is a overly ambitious jerk off because all he cares about is becoming the Speaker of the House. He has no principles.
Yeah.
And I told the Midas Touch guys, him and I are the same age. This guy looks 200 years old because he's got all that poison in him from Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And he's drinking from that poison chalice. You know, McConnell is sort of who he is. Okay. McConnell has played the game exactly who he is. You can like him or dislike him, but at least if I gave you a scouting report on McConnell, you're like, okay, I can predict what McConnell's going to do, what are his moves, and he did all that.
Yeah. Yeah.
McCarthy was supposed to be a young gun. He was supposed to be an aspirational conservative. He was supposed to be this new form of compassionate conservatism. And he's become a MAGA train wreck and a hypocrite and a full out liar.
Yeah. Yeah. So he said he was the one who said, I think Putin pays Trump. He said that.
Yeah.
2015 or what. Yeah.
So let me ask you that question. So how much did Putin pay Trump? What do you think the number was?
Oh, God, I don't know. I we'll find out because now we have the numbers. My initial theory back when I started doing this is that he didn't pay him. He forgave debts.
Right.
You know, there's a difference. Psychologically, there's a difference. When you have debt, it's really.
So that's why the Deutsche Bank accounts got closed. Remember in November. Mm-hmm. The Deutsche Bank guy said, well, we're going to call the demand loan $350 million. We're going to call it in January. And then all of a sudden they said, well, these accounts are now closed.
Yeah.
Okay, so what happened there? I'd like to know what happened there. Why were those accounts? If he owes you $350 million, you're not closing his accounts.
Yeah, it's very – the Deutsche thing is really strange. Do you know in Casablanca, there's a scene where right at the beginning Bogart doesn't let the German guy into the casino. Yeah. And he's like, you know, I know who you are. You're lucky the bar is open to you. And that guy actually works for Deutsche Bank because Deutsche Bank is, that's how they came into business, doing money stuff for the Nazis. And it's the same ethos. It appears that there.
I mean, this is the same people that stole all the art and they hid it in different caves and stuff. You know,
it's not good. So, okay. Last question. You'll like this one. Now, right now, from what I understand, I can see you have a stack of books behind you and one of them says Bitcoin on it. This is kind of one of your interests and your business things now. I don't understand cryptocurrency at all. I just don't get it. I don't understand why it takes energy to make it. I don't understand why we don't want a government to back it. I don't understand this guy with a Japanese name that maybe invented it and no one knows who he is.
Right.
So enlighten me.
Okay,
what do you see in this?
So I would recommend this book to you then. Okay, this is Dominic Frisby's book. It was written in 2014. If you don't want to read it, go to Mooch FM, my podcast. I interviewed Dominic this week. But Dominic's book will explain everything that you need to know about crypto. And what I love about this book is it was written in 2014. So you're like, well, yeah, that book's 7 years old. Why would I read that book? Because he predicts everything that happened in this book. And so I think it fortifies you with what is going on in cryptocurrency. And I want to point out to your listeners that I started as a crypto skeptic. I started as somebody that didn't believe in cryptocurrencies. I got trained in Warren Buffett's discipline. He thinks it's rat poison. However, one of his acolytes, Bill Miller, 20 years younger than Buffett at age 71, thinks that it is rat poison, but the rat poison is fiat currency, where he owns a ton of Bitcoin. And so it would be impossible for me to explain it in 3 minutes. But here's what I would say to you, because you're intellectually curious. I would read a few books on it. That book I would read, a gentleman by the name of Von Pritzker, Pritzker, P-R-I-T-Z-K-E-R, wrote a book called Inventing Bitcoin. It's a small book. And if you read those two books, you will know more than 99% of the population on crypto. And I've been doing this for 33 years. And the reason why I have $500 million in cryptocurrency right now is that it has adopted Medcalfe's law of networking. So what is Medcalfe's law? Just quickly. Professor Medcalfe said, if you're creating a network and you can create a network effect, then whatever it is that you're doing, you can value it in terms of the exponential growth of the network. Okay, so what has been illustrative of that? Amazon, yeah. Medcalfe's law, it scaled into a retail network. Google, it scaled into a search and advertising network. Facebook, right. It scaled pursuant to Medcalfe's law into a social network. Well, you know, we have currency and we have tradable goods and we have stores of value in our society. Another great book, by the way, is this one. This is about the ascent of money. Great book, because Neil explains in the book what money actually is. And Greg, just so I'm clear with you, money is always worth less than the goods and services that we're trading for. It's wampum, seashells. It could be a gold coin with the stamp of a political leader's profile on it. Let's look at this for a second. For those listeners that are not Italian, this is an Italian single, okay? Greg understands that because he's Italian.
It's a $100 bill he's holding up.
Yeah. Right, yeah, it's a $100 bill. This is a single, right? This is an Italian single. But what is it? It's a piece of fabric. It's got ink on it and a counterfeit strip on it and Ben Franklin's face on it. But all it is a piece of paper. Yet I can go to the pizzeria. They're going to give me food for it. Or I can ask the landscaper to cut my grass. He'll do that service for me. So when you really understand money, the money is not this. It's the trust between us that this is important. Let me make me more illustrative. I have 200,000 digits in my bank account. I can wire those digits to the Mercedes-Benz dealership. They then show up with a G-Wagon. But what is it that I just sent them? Well, there were just a couple of digits.
So what is, yeah.
So what is money? It is a ledger between people. So what Satoshi Nakamoto did in 2009, after many refinements, there were other failed DigiCash strategies. The group of people, I think it's more than one person, and obviously Frisbee has his pulse on who he thinks it is. But that group of people basically said, if we can decentralize a network and we can prove that the ledger is safe and people can trust the network, then we're going to improve currency. And oh, by the way, the currency won't be manipulated by governments, because this $100 bill, to $1971 dollars, has the purchasing power of a 2021 $100 bill.
Wow.
Because we devalued our currency. And so in this is what I was talking about with monetary policy. In the last year, Greg, we've increased the dollars in circulation by 26%. So we just printed money to try to solve our problem. It's showing up in art, it's showing up in real estate, it's showing up in different places in the stock market. But where it's also showing up is in your savings account. It's eroding your savings because the dollars that you earned are now worth less than the ones that you earned at the time that you earned them, because now everything that you're trying to buy with them is more expensive. That's right. Inflation, right? And so what Bitcoin It is a decentralized monetary network that's growing and scaling, and it is adopting MedCAS law. It has over 100 million users today. If it gets to a billion users, which I predict it will by 2025, those coins will be worth several hundred thousand dollars. And so for that reason, I've told my clients that I need them to have a 1-2% exposure to Bitcoin. I don't need them to go crazy in Bitcoin, but I think it's part of the future and I want them to be a part of it. And if I'm wrong and it's worthless, which I can prove to you that it isn't pursuant to Metcalfe's law, you don't lose that much money. You have 1-2% of your portfolio in it. But I would encourage you and your listeners to spend some time looking at it. And once you do, if you have that eureka moment that I've had after being a skeptic, in the words of Michael Saylor, the CEO of MicroStrategy, he has $3 billion worth of Bitcoin. He would say, well, the first Bitcoin is very hard to buy. But once you own it, you're like, okay, I don't own enough of it. And I'll leave you with that thought, because I do think it's a very valuable thing that's happening in our society right now. And I don't want to be an old dinosaur. I want to look at, adapt, and embrace the new things that are happening.
Okay, I'm going to read the books. Anthony Scaramucci, thank you so much for joining us. This was really fun. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for taking so much time with me this morning.
Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Sofia Tereshchenko provided the Russian voiceover. Thanks to Stephanie St. John for the narration. Thanks to Allison Gill, Jason Smith, Mackenzie Mizell, and everyone else involved with producing this podcast. Please subscribe to the Prevail website. Visit gregoliar.com. That's GREGOLEAR.com. Until next time, we shall prevail.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with privacy mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course. Present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is! Drawing board or...
Miro! All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.